Silence.
Oppenheimer.
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Play Radio.
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 35 of Nerd Pride Radio. 35, the minimum age for a president of the United States. So, ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome. My name is Mike Jones. I'm a D&D nerd, a history nerd, sci-fi nerd, comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd plus. There's probably like seven other kinds of nerd that I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff I just can't fit in my head anymore. As always, you're listening to the best-smelling podcast on the internet. That's right. Nerd Pride Radio smells exactly like Chemical X. Before we head into the meticulously plotted portion of the podcast, though, it's time for...
Oppenheimer!
Yeah, a little meta talk. This is where I sit back and talk about the podcast, the website, stuff that's going on, pull back the curtain just a little bit. And in this particular case, I'm doing it to apologize for my absence last week. Turns out my laptop is falling apart, and I can't afford a new one right now. And I don't know what happened last week. I spent about 20, 30 minutes trying and starting and stopping. And I had this electrical buzz in the noise that I absolutely could not remove. I tried and tried and tried, and I am so sorry. This week, I think I finally got it sorted out. The lines look clean, so I'm hoping. Fingers crossed. Let's hope this turns out. So anyway, my apologies. Hopefully we're back on schedule. But yeah, you know me. I am really unreliable. I lie to you all the time. So, you know, what are you going to do? Which brings us right to the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast. This is the time for me where I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy, busy week, I add it to my master list, and the best stuff off that list gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. And the first thing on our master list this week, the Science Corner!
Oh, she blinded me with science.
She blinded me with science.
Blinded me with science.
That's right. That quote-unquote music means if you don't walk away now, you might be in danger of learning something. And this week on the Science Corner, flexagons. All right? Some of you already know what I'm talking about. Here's the deal with flexagons. I'm going to go a little meta here again. I was reading IO9 the other day. I mean, like, yesterday. All right, that's how recent this is. And on IO9, there is an article and a link to a video about hexaflexagons. And it's mathematical looking. It's interesting. I am sucked in. I am hypnotized by the flexagons immediately. And so first thing I do, pop open my master list, type in hexaflexagon. It's there. It's ready. It's coming up this week. Okay. In fact, I'm so excited about it, I go out and I find patterns for them, and I build myself my own hexaflexagon right there, and it's exciting, it's awesome, it's cool, I'll describe it in just a minute. Right, I get home that night, and I am talking to my wife, and she is flipping through stuff on the internet, and suddenly she looks up at me and says, "Hey, what's a hexaflexagon?" I'm like, what? She says, "What's a hexaflexagon?" I mean, I just learned about it, like, 5 hours before. Just made my own, was entranced, was so excited to bring it to you guys, and here my wife, out of nowhere, is asking me what a hexaflexagon is. She doesn't read IO9. What's going on? And she says, well, it's right here on YouTube. Apparently, the video I watched, admittedly, was a YouTube video, but whether it was IO9, whether it's just that the gal who does it, I'll talk about her in a minute, is popular enough, whatever, Hexaflexicon pops right to the top of the YouTube, hey, you might want to watch this list. And so here's my wife talking about it. So it's a little disappointing that here I am so excited. I find some really cool nerd item, and I'm so excited to put it on my master list. I'm so excited to bring it to you guys. And YouTube beats me to it. YouTube teaches my wife about hexaflexicons before I even have the chance to open my mouth about it. It's so sad. I mean, I'm glad that nerd culture is that popular. I'm glad that this sort of stuff is popping up. I'm glad that there are other avenues, venues, where people can get their daily dose of amazing science. But darn it, I wanted to do that. But, hey, without further ado, I will go ahead and tell you anyway, even if YouTube already did it. All right. So the video is from a gal called Vi Hart. And Vi Hart is a 20-something math nerd. She lists her occupation as professional mathemusician, and she puts out videos on the internet to talk about math stuff, and it's really cool. All right, she's got a whole string of them. Her main series, I think, is called Doodling in Math Class, but she's got a bunch of other videos, things that are out there, and she's just fascinating to listen to. Just tune in, and in fact, the first thing you should do right now, because I cannot do hexaflexicons any justice at all in an audio medium here, is go on the internet, go to YouTube, and type in hexaflexicon, and boom, it's the first video right there. It's got her hands manipulating a little bit of paper, and you'll watch the video, and you will be just as amazed as I was. Go check it out. Go look. I'll wait. Was that not the coolest? Oh my God. All right, now, for those of you who don't listen to me and didn't go watch the YouTube video, let me describe it. A hexaflexicon, discovered in, according to Vi, 1939, is a shape, a folded piece of paper, a construct that, when folded correctly, it looks like a hexagon. All right, you got a little hexagon in your hands made out of folded paper. You can see where the flaps go under and over each other, and it all locks together. You tape it shut or glue it shut at the end. And I built myself one of these things based on her instructions, and I went to, apparently you can just go to flexagon.net, and there are a million patterns for flexagons. The hexaflexagon is my favorite, the hexagon ones, but there are lots of others that you can build. And here's what it does. You've got this folded piece of paper, flat hexagon in your hands, right? And then you pinch it together, so it makes little triangles. Remember those little, I don't even remember what they were called, those little, you'd fold the paper, the square paper, into a little butterfly shape, and you'd open and close it, and then you'd read inside the flap, and it would supposedly predict your future or tell you what your girlfriend's name was or, you know, whatever. It looks like that. You fold it in like that into three little triangles, and then instead of unfolding it the way you had it, you pull the flaps out, and it unfolds inside out. And so you're looking at the other side of the paper. All right, but now here's the weird part. If you unfold it again, you fold it in and then unfold it again, you're now looking at a third side of the paper. You're turning this thing, constantly turning it inside out on itself, and it has three faces. It's just amazing. You can color them. She does it in the video. Go watch. You can color them, and so you've got a red face and a green face and a blue face, and as you unfold, that's all the paper, and it unfolds to red, to green, to blue, over and over. And then you build the more complex version of the hexaflexagon, and it actually has six faces to it. So that when you fold it together and then unfold it, you could be looking at any one of six faces of this flexagon. And all, so you'll be looking at, you know, I've got red and blue. So I'm looking at red on one side, blue on the back. Well, now I turned inside out to open up the inside. And well, now I've got green and my red's on the back. So now I've got red and green. Then you can fold it a different way, open it up. You've got orange. Six different faces come out of this thing. It's hypnotic. Like I say, my audio rendition here cannot do it justice. You have to watch this thing in action. My wife asks me and says, okay, so what's a hexaflexagon? So we watch the video. She is duly amazed and calls in our two littlest children who watch the video with us. They're amazed. We call in the two older boys. And now the whole family is sitting down watching this two-minute video of Vi Hart demonstrating a hexaflexagon. And we're all just stunned. And as soon as the video gets done, my oldest looks over at me, Gygax, and he says, oh, I have to make one of those. Show me how. Show me. So we did. We go out, and you go to flexagon.net, and you print up the pattern for we start off with the small hexaflexagon, which is the three-sided one, so it's actually this gets silly. It's a trihexaflexagon. And so we printed up the pattern, we fold it, cut it, do all the things we do, glue the ends together, and sure enough, it works perfectly. All right, and then he's so excited by that one, he's like, all right, now I have to do the big one. So we cut out the six-sided hexaflexagon, the hexahexaflexagon, if you will. And this one takes forever. And I had done one at work already, and I did it really quickly. I didn't follow all the instructions, and so my folds weren't quite crisp. I was doing it fast. And it didn't quite work. I mean, I got it to work, but it wasn't pretty. But Gygax took his time, and he creased all the edges properly, and then he folds and glues, and then he recreases, and then he tapes it, and then the whole business works. And it worked perfectly. He's got it at school right now. Otherwise, I would start folding it in my hands for you so that you could at least hear the beauty of the hexaflexagon in action. But he took it to school so he could show all of his friends, because it's just that cool. I mean, and he took a while to puzzle it out, because there's certain rhythms and patterns to it. You have real, out of the six colors, you get to lock into three sides. So he has sides A, B, and C that he can just flip through A, B, C, A, B, C, and you just keep turning it inside out, and he keeps rotating through that. But then you turn it a little bit, fold it a slightly different way, and now all of a sudden you're looking at A, B, D, A, B, D, A, B, D. And so it's a trick to figure out, okay, this pattern of three, if you fold it a certain way, that lets you unlock, you know, side E, and now you've got E in the rotation. Well, now you take it back to the center one, and now you can unlock side F, and you put that one into the rotation. It's just the coolest thing. Like I say, go watch the video. All credit to Vihart. The woman is amazing. If I was giving out a regular Nerd of the Week award, I would totally give it to Vi, because her videos are incredible. I'm flipping through her stuff. And one of the first ones I found was binary finger dancing. Now, I mentioned on episode 32, I mentioned that 32 is the number of combinations you can have on your fingers when you're counting in binary on one hand, which I do regularly. In fact, I actually go further. I will obsessively count from 1 to 1,024 in binary on 10 fingers. And, well, anyway, if I can get all the way to 1,024 without losing track and all my fingers line up and boom, I hit 1,024 and everything's down, that's a good day. Usually, you know, I would say two times out of three, I wind up getting to the end going, 976? What? How did I do that? I can't. Oh, and then I have to start over. But Vi does the same thing, except she even, for the sake of the video camera, she actually labeled her fingers with their proper binary totals on them, and then she does a little binary finger dance to show you how the totals work. Really super cool. So again, hats off to Vihart, Doodling in Math Class, her other YouTube video series. Go watch, have fun. She deserves a lot of credit for this. Very cool stuff. Did I mention I've been doing a little bit of reading? That's right, it's time for the Nerd Pride Book Report. I have been, while not making podcasts, I am now occupying my time otherwise with reading obsessively. And you all know I'm reading Song of Ice and Fire. Well, not true anymore, because I finished. I finished book five, and my only commentary... How does he end it there? Oh, I want book six. I can't wait 3 years. This is going to kill me. And again, for those of you who have been reading Song of Ice and Fire from the very beginning, and you had to wait 5 years between book four and book five, I am so sorry for you guys. Obviously, I only have a small taste of your pain. I'm not going to even comment on the book at all, except to say that, obviously, I still love this book series. I love everything this man has done. I am thrilled to death with these books. Cannot wait for book six, which he says, oh, yeah, probably about 3 years, but it'll be a lot larger than the previous ones. Oh, a lot larger than 1,000 pages? Oh, yeah, probably about 1,500 for book six, and then another 15 for book seven. I can't wait. Cannot wait. I lied to you. I said I wasn't going to do a lot of commentary on it. I will say that part of what I love about this series is the unbelievable magnitude of this world. The world is at least as involved as Middle-earth, at least as involved as everything that Tolkien did, and yet we get that history, that depth of a world revealed to us through absolutely gripping action throughout. As opposed to, as much as I love Lord of the Rings, I love The Hobbit, I love, if you can hear the sirens in the background, sorry. Yeah, there they go. I hope those people are okay. Anyway, as much as I love Middle-earth, I love Tolkien, I love all the stories, y'all know that Tolkien was very much in love with his world and very much in love with his characters and occasionally could get a little long-winded in presenting us some history. Not enough to make me stop loving the stories, but Martin doesn't do that with Song of Ice and Fire, or at least if he does, I'm so sucked in that I don't notice. I mean, he gives us history, he gives us tales, but it never seems to interrupt that flow. And when I say he's created a world as involved, as deep as Tolkien's, I'm not kidding. Those of you who have read it, those of you who haven't read it, do you know how many named characters there are in the Song of Ice and Fire series so far? Go look online. It took me a little bit, but I found a list of named characters in Song of Ice and Fire. 1,700 characters. 1,700 named characters, which sometimes it gets a bit confusing, and yet somehow, every time I get to a storyline, no, he reminds us of who the people are. We bring it back. It's absolutely gripping. This world has 12,000 years of history. He has an entire globe's worth of lands and nations that are all intertwined and all have this long, convoluted history, down to local legends from certain areas and these massive wars that cover continents. And I say a globe's worth, but you know what? He hasn't confirmed in the books that this is even a round world. I mean, we already know that the seasons do not work on any sort of Earth-like schedule. And we assume that it's a globe. We assume we're working on a round planet, but he's never proven that to us. We've got some hints. I mean, the prophecy said that you have to go east to get west, but that could mean a lot of different things. But again, amazing, amazing set of books. Absolutely love them. I can't wait. I can't believe it will probably be, realistically, what, 2020 before I'm reading the final book? Honestly? I mean, seriously, the James Webb Space Telescope's going to be up before that, right? And that thing's forever away. Oh, so many things to wait for. You know what? I should have just put it off. I should have just watched the TV series and waited. Yeah, in fact, he says one of his big worries is that the TV show is going to get caught up to him, and then they're not going to have another season because he will not have written the next book yet. So, go figure. But, you know what, that's not why I was doing a book report. I wasn't even here to talk about Song of Ice and Fire. That was supposed to be an aside. The real book report is, I can't believe, I was in a little college town near here. We were going to do a college visit for my oldest son, who will be going away to college next year. And while we're in the bookstore there, we were just browsing around, whatever, and sitting on the half-price bookshelf, even though it turned out to not actually be half price, I paid full cover price for it, but sitting on the bookshelf there, this oversized paperback version of The Best Time Travel Stories of the 20th Century. Now, I love science fiction and fantasy short stories of any stripe. I have tons of compendiums of these things on my bookshelves. I read, you know, the year's best science fiction, or, you know, best science fiction stories of when I read a lot of these things. All right. And best time travel stories of the 20th century. I love time travel. You guys know I love time travel. How can I not? All right. So clearly this is a must have for me. And the book is, this is the cool part, edited by Harry Turtledove. And Harry Turtledove is famous for all of his alternate history novels, which are really cool in their own right. But he was the editor of Best Time Travel Stories of the 20th Century. And furthermore, if I flip over to the inside cover of this thing, Harry Turtledove signed this book. I have his signature. Not like he's a huge famous dude, but he's famous enough, right, in our nerd circles. And his signature right here on the inside of the book. Go figure. And I just picked it up for cover price. Apparently he made a visit to the college at some point, signed a bunch of books, and they had a few left over. So lucky, lucky me. And as far as my book review goes, dude, Love this book. They are arranged in chronological order, I believe, from when they were written. And so I would say about a third of them so far I've already read because I've had them in other collections. But even of those that I know I've read before, a lot of them I can't remember how they ended. I know I've read it. I just can't remember the details of them. And just absolutely fascinating. I have this thing for old science fiction that a lot of times I find it tedious because, again, the world changes and it sometimes becomes really hard to overlook how outdated certain things are. But with some of them, especially with these time travel stories, if they've got a good enough concept behind it, then I'm willing to overlook the inaccuracies caused simply by the passage of time here and enjoy it for the concept. You know, the things like, I don't know, it always throws me when you're on a spaceship and the whole crew pulls out their packs of cigarettes and starts lighting up, you know, on a spaceship, right, inside, okay, anyway, which, by the way, we saw, I don't even know what the story was, my wife was watching some 1930s, 1940s science fiction black and white garbage on TV, and I sat down with her because there's a spaceship. The crew is all in a panic because there's some creature in the hold and they can't stop and it's picking off the crew one by one. I mean, it was actually very much Alien. It really was. The whole theme of it, except of course that instead of the really creepy alien, the alien turned out to be, you know, a dude in a big rubber suit and looked really fakey. But he was completely unkillable, and he was slaughtering crew members left and right, and I had to sit down and watch with her because I was just hypnotized. Oh, it was idiotic. It was completely stupid. I'm sure even in its day, it was probably pretty stupid, and yet we couldn't stop watching it. And the absolute best part was here they are all in a panic wondering what to do about this creature that's down there, and, well, we've got him contained for now, but we don't know how long those doors will hold, and we don't know what we're going to... And then as they're talking, yeah, sure enough, the whole crew pulls out packs of cigarettes, they all light up, and they're all sitting there, again, in a spaceship, cigarettes going, using up all their valuable oxygen, fouling the air with smoke. I find it absolutely fascinating. It's really cool stuff. But anyway, best time travel stories of the 20th century. I have read all but the last two, and I am just having a blast with this. I love time travel stories. So how would you feel about heading into the Unnamed History segment?
Don't know much about history.
That's right, and this week we're going to double up on our history, unnamed or not. All right, these are two things that I have encountered that have just fascinated me, and I had to go do more research on them. And I ran into them in the last week or so because I was working with my kids on their homework. This is specifically my third grader, all right? One of them was a book that he had to read for class in third grade. And the other one was a project we were working on to do some research for one of his badges for Cub Scouts. All right, and the first one, the book he had to read a book called Sequoia, and it's about a Native American named Sequoia. He was a Cherokee Indian, and the whole point, the reason that Sequoia is famous and the whole gist of this book was explaining that Sequoia developed a written language for Cherokee. Okay? No small feat. Sequoia also he was born George Gist suspected that he was half French trader, half Cherokee, something like that, or that possibly his father was half French, half Cherokee, and his mother was full-blooded. Doesn't make any difference. Anyway, he was part of the Cherokee tribe. Working with his daughter, Ayoka, she was young at the time, but she was assisting him. Sequoia was fascinated by the idea of written language, fascinated that the white man had this huge advantage that they could actually write down messages on their talking papers and send them back and forth. And he thought, absolutely, absolutely, I have to be able to do this for the Cherokee. All right, and so he sits down to try it out. And his first attempt was he decided that he was going to develop a symbol for every word in Cherokee. And then he discovered what the Chinese should have figured out several thousand years before is that, oh my God, that's a pain in the ass. There's just too much. There's just too much. You can't develop that from scratch. There's no way to come up with, you know, even, you know, several hundred symbols, much less the several thousand that would be required for a full language. There's no way to come up with enough symbols, make them recognizable, be able to teach them to people. He just couldn't do it. It overwhelmed him. So he stops. And then he decides that, okay, his next step is instead of that, he did a full study of the Cherokee language, what makes up the words. And he understood the idea that letters, symbols, represent sounds. And so he went with a common scheme for a lot of languages in that he was going to develop a syllabary. All right, so unlike an alphabet, such as we have, he's going to create a set of symbols where each symbol, each character, represents a syllable, all right? A not just a single sound, but a set of sounds within the Cherokee language. And he comes up with 85-ish symbols. And he borrows, I mean, just steals outright. There's Roman numerals in there. Not Roman numerals, Roman characters. So typical Roman Latin alphabet. There's numbers in there. There's symbols stolen from other languages, symbols that he just made up. And for the most part, he just used them because they were symbols. And there's absolutely no connection between, you know, if he had the letter A in his syllabary, had absolutely nothing to do with the letter A in English or any other language for that matter. He just needed symbols. And here were some handy ones that are fairly easy to write. And he made it work. Now, in the process of making it work, he had to leave his wife because, well, she took all of his work and burned it while he was gone because she was positive that he was working on something involved with witchcraft. She was sure that this was evil sorcery, and so she burned everything he had. So he moves off, he leaves his wife, he takes his one daughter, Ayoko, with him, and the two of them are now living in a small cabin somewhere, and they continue to work, and then, well, turns out that the nearby village of Cherokee came in and burned his house to the ground, thus destroying all of his work again. Because again, witchcraft, dude. Seriously, can't be doing that. So, but third time through, he finally gets it all done. And he gets his syllabary done. And he then takes it to the Cherokee chiefs. All right, he takes it to the heads of their tribes. I had the guy's name. I don't know who it was. All right, anyway, it doesn't make any difference. He takes it to the assembled chiefs, and he presents them with his syllabary. And they, some of them, were a little concerned at the idea of witchcraft, but most of them were familiar enough with the concept of writing to understand that, okay, he's got something going here. But they still didn't quite believe him. I mean, he had, you know, he leaves the room, he has them recite off a whole bunch of words, and then his daughter, while he's out of the room, his daughter writes down whatever words they're speaking. He comes back in, and he's able to read them off and tell them exactly what it was that they said while he was gone, because it's all there in writing. And they were still a little doubtful. Okay, they had this concept that, all right, maybe, you know what, this isn't really full language. This is, you know, yeah, you've got some scratchings here that are reminders or pictograms or something like that. But he kept pushing at him, and he wound up carrying a message, had the chief write down a message, and he was able to carry it to another Cherokee chief or someone in power, an authority somewhere else, was able to transmit this message across miles and accurately, you know, not just single words, but full concepts and phrases and sentences. And they were impressed. And they said, you know what, dude, you got it. Sequoia, go ahead. Let's push forward. And so he set up schools to teach the Cherokee. And they were so successful that within a couple of years, the literacy rate among Cherokee Indians was rivaling that of the surrounding white settlers, all right? In fact, surpassing. They started their own Cherokee language newspaper. It was huge. Here's the amazing part about Sequoia. Here's the thing that absolutely blew my mind. I mean, up until now, I already had it on my master list, all right? I was already ready to bring this to you guys just based on what you have already heard, because I'm just fascinated. I am in awe of a dude that's going to create a written language from nothing. All right. But then, as I did further research, here's the part that blew me out of the water. before creating his Cherokee syllabary, Sequoia couldn't read or write in any language. Chew on that. It wasn't like he learned to read and write in English, or whichever, French, English, Spanish, doesn't make any difference. It's not like he learned to read and write in English first and went, wow, this concept is cool. I really need to take this to my people. No, he couldn't read or write at all. All he knew of was the concept. He understood the idea that they write down symbols, and then they can translate it and turn those symbols into words. That's all he knew. And from that, working completely on his own, the dude created a written language out of nothing. My hat is off. Holy cow. I can't. Just absolutely in awe. I am stunned. I can't believe that someone could do that. That is dedication. That is amazing. All right, and he is now a Cherokee national hero for good reason. That just stunning. All right. That's Sequoia. The other one, we're working in Scouts, and the badge that we're working on is Folklore and Tall Tales. This is for third graders, so it's the Bear Scouts in Cubs. And we're working on Folklore and Tall Tales. And so they have a whole bunch of suggested names, and I went out and got a whole bunch of samplings of different folklore, you know, tall tales about Paul Bunyan and Pecos Bill, and some of them are people created out of whole cloth, some of them are real people who then have these tall tales, exaggerated stories attached to them, like Johnny Appleseed, for example. That's the common one that all the kids seem to know. And listed among these in the book for the Scouts is Charlie Parkhurst, who I had never heard of before. And so I was looking up stories about all these different things, but I found a website about Charlie Parkhurst, which then led me to some other research. And Charlie Parkhurst was a stagecoach driver, so back in the 1800s, and by all accounts, a very good one. All right, 30 years Charlie drove this same route, and 30 years, according to legend, Charlie never lost a passenger, never lost any of his goods to robbery, accident, other incidents. Charlie was apparently extremely good at what he did. Charlie eventually gets too old to drive anymore. All right, he wound up being in an accident and lost an eye, kept driving, kept going, and then eventually became too weak to keep driving. So Charlie retires, and Charlie's living just fine in retirement for, I don't know, 5-10 years before Charlie finally passes away, dies of cancer. And he dies. The neighbors finally figure out that he's missing. Someone goes to look for him. They bring in the doctor, coroner, mortician, whoever it is. They bring the body out, have it examined. Turns out the entire time, Charlie was a woman. Nobody had a clue. I thought that was a pretty cool story. And what's more, not only was Charlie a woman, but through examination, Charlie had had kids at some point, at least one. So, amazing. So, anyway, the legend of Charlie Parkhurst, the story of Charlie Parkhurst. Again, true story, but then there are tall tales attached to Charlie's life to go along with that. But I thought, that's a pretty cool story. I learned something new. And I'm always amazed and happy when I learn something new from a source where I didn't expect it. I mean, like I say, we're flipping through tall tales, and they're, you know, again, it's Pecos Bill, it's King Kamehameha from Hawaii. By the way, King Kamehameha, real person, unified the Hawaiian Islands just before the coming of the white man, thus helping preserve them against the white intrusion and exploitation, etc., etc. But the legends that go with him, yeah, apparently to become king, yeah, King Arthur had to pull a sword out of a stone. No, King Kamehameha had to flip over a 3.5-ton boulder because no one else could do it. But now, since he's the true and chosen king, he flips over this 3-ton boulder. Boom, he's king. That's how the prophecy works. So anyway, like I say, there were lots of these out there. And some of them were interesting. Some of them I heard some stories I hadn't heard before. But Charlie Parkhurst, I was like, this is completely out of the blue. I had no idea that this person even existed in history. I was thrilled to know it. So, of course, goes on the master list, and I come to share it with you guys. Hope that makes your day. And now it's time for a Nerd Culture Report.
I thought this was bowling for weirdos.
No, don't be silly, Gonzo. Of course it's not, but you are very, very close. All right. I am fascinated by the concept of product placement. I've always loved advertising in general, and product placement is a part of that, and I love seeing clever product placement. However, most of the time, product placement annoys me. If it's obvious enough that I notice it, most of the time, it drives me batty. You know what? I don't mind on American Idol that all the judges are drinking Coke, or they're drinking something out of Coca-Cola cups. And I don't mind that they're, when the camera hits them on a close-up, they always have those cups turned so that the Coca-Cola logo is front and center and very prominent in the camera. That doesn't bother me. You know what? They got to drink something. If Coca-Cola wants its logo there, it doesn't hurt me. I don't mind that. But you know what I do mind? They're ruining my American Pickers. I love American Pickers, don't you? These guys are awesome. This is, which, by the way, of all of the antique, and well, I guess they're not all antiques, but the History Channel, Discovery Channel, stuff like this, where they do, it's American Pickers, it's Pawn Stars, it's Storage Wars, it's, you know, discovering treasures amongst, you know, garbage. Discovering these odd, quirky things, learning the history of them, and all right, of all of those, and I've watched all of them, American Pickers is my favorite. And you know why? Because Mike and Frank appear to, at least on camera, love what they do. They are thrilled to death. And yes, they're pickers. They're finding stuff amongst garbage. They're finding stuff in people's treasure hoards. They're finding stuff in odd, out-of-the-way places. And they're bringing it back specifically for the purpose to sell it off again. It's not like they're keeping most of this stuff. But every item they find, they love. You can just see it. You just see how much they enjoy what they're doing. And whereas Pawn Stars, you know, that's the one I would watch second most after American Pickers. Pawn Stars, you watch people bring stuff into the shop, and, oh, God, they always have a carefully scripted history lesson about where this thing came from, and it always looks like they know everything. And clearly, they've done their research ahead of time. They know what's coming in. They know what's going to be on the show. And I don't feel the love for the items. I mean, sometimes you can see where they're excited about something, but I just don't feel, I don't feel the same joy out of these people. Or especially Storage Wars. Ugh, that one. I mean, those are the three I would watch most often. I've seen a lot of the others, but American Pickers seem to love what they do. So I've always enjoyed watching the show. But now, all the new episodes, at some point in the show, someone has to go, oh, hey, look, there's a Subway. And they have to stop and get a sandwich. And they have to talk about their sandwich and talk about how much they like their sandwich. And they have to use up 3 minutes of my show pretending that this isn't a scripted event. Pretending that, oh, well, hey, we were going to do this anyway. This is, oh, God, it kills me. All right? Kills me. I hate it because it's so obviously fake and it takes me out of, I mean, again, I know that with most of these shows, I know that they're scripted. I know that they've got a lot of parts where they have done their research or someone has done research for them and they just try and make it look as natural as possible. And I get all that, but American Pickers does a better job of putting up that illusion than the other shows do. And that's part of what I love about it, is it feels real, at least to me. And as soon as they go into a Subway ad right there in the middle of the show, it takes me out of it and it reminds me that, oh yeah, that's right. They're just doing this for the money. Damn it. And I know, look, the Subway ads like that, and there's lots of shows doing stuff like that now. It's a throwback to the soap operas, okay? The original soap operas, back when they were on radio. That's why they call them soap operas, is because most of them, because these were aimed at housewives at home doing housework in the middle of the day, and so therefore the soap operas were often sponsored by cleaning companies. The biggest ones in the beginning were sponsored by detergent companies, soap makers. And so the characters would, they didn't have actual ads within the show itself. I mean, as in commercial breaks, like we traditionally think of now, but the way their sponsors got it in is that at some point in every 15-minute episode, and that's all these things were when they started, because they didn't think that housewives could have either A, the attention span for a longer show, or B, the time out of their busy day of cleaning to sit and listen to anything for more than 15 minutes. So they kept them short, you know, because that's what the ladies need. And so sometime during the 15-minute program, one of the characters would have to talk about the sponsor's product and have to mention that, oh, yeah, well, I'm using these soap flakes. And, oh, you wouldn't believe how white my husband's shirts are getting. And this, and that's what they would do, exactly like the Subway ads in American Pickers. And I can only imagine it must have been equally as frustrating for people. Well, maybe not equally as frustrating because, you know what did they have to compare it to back then? I mean, this was a brand new venture, and if that's the way the sponsors got their ads in, I suppose, you know. And I don't mind so much, you know, watching some of the reality shows. I used to watch Big Brother. I haven't watched it in about 3-4 years. I used to watch Big Brother, and Big Brother had lots of stuff like that, where it usually dealt with prizes, all right? And so we're giving the people in the house some sort of reward, and the reward happens to be a big name brand product. And, you know, here are people who've been living in a house isolated with just these 10 other people for how long? And they're sick and tired of this. They miss the outside world. And so every prize that comes in is a huge treat, and they react appropriately. So they're always thrilled to see whatever the sponsor's product is. Most egregiously when the prize is, hey, we're going to give you a sneak preview of this movie that's coming out in 1 week. And so they bring in a screener copy, and the prize winners, 3 or 4 of them, get to go up to a private room and watch this. Or if they're really lucky, they get taken out to a private theater where they get to watch an advanced copy of the film. And then they get to come back, and they always, always rave about how wonderful it was. Well, of course, because you know what? They haven't seen any TV or movies for 10 weeks. You could show them anything and they'd be thrilled. And they know how they're supposed to react for the camera. And so they get a good ad in. And those never really bothered me as much. But, I mean, it's still obvious. But it didn't bother me as much. But now, I don't know. It just seems so... And I know, with TiVo, DVRs, internet viewing, it's so easy to skip commercials nowadays. It's so easy to tune them out and not pay attention when it's a separate block of time that it's really paying off for sponsors to be able to work it into the program. Because, well, if you're going to see the program, you can't help but see our product. That's just the way the world works. And I understand why they do it. I just wish it was cooler. All right, because, for example, and this is why I bring this up in the first place, what is the greatest use of product placement of all time, in your opinion? All right, I'll give you a second to think about it because there's lots of them to choose from. All right, I'll give you a moment. All right, some of you are right now. You're yelling at your iPod and going, "But it's E.T. Reese's Pieces, duh!" Well, no, nice try. That one was pretty good. That one was iconic, and it's one that everyone remembers. I mean, not only do they feature as a plot point in the film, but you get E.T. himself to say Reese's Pieces at some point. Or maybe that was just for the commercial. See, you know what? The ad tie-ins were so pervasive that I don't even remember if he actually said Reese's Pieces in the movie, or if I'm just remembering the commercials where I know he said them for sure. Doesn't make any difference. That's how effective that was. And it was really good. And E.T. was actually full of other product placement as well. Whatever pizza they were eating at the beginning, the delivery pizza company's logo was prominently displayed on the box. There was a lot of stuff in that one. But no, it's not E.T. Okay, maybe you're thinking of FedEx in Castaway? Yeah? Because that one was pretty good too. All right? I did some research. I don't know that FedEx actually paid for their spot. They were actually a little concerned because, you know, the whole premise of the movie is that a FedEx plane crashes. You know, that's a FedEx plane crashes and all the packages are lost. Well, except one. That's the premise of the movie. Doesn't necessarily make FedEx look the greatest, but did you notice everything else about FedEx in that movie? Yes, they had a terrible accident. Not their fault. Bad weather. Oh, it was horrible. But everything else about that movie, FedEx was portrayed as a precision machine. I mean, that their employees were loyal and dedicated and committed to you, the consumer. They really were. Everything about it. I mean, they were spot on and knowledgeable, and they had their timetables worked out, and their managers were dead on top of everything. All right? But even that, while being awesome product placement, spectacular for FedEx, all right, was not the greatest. In fact, not even this is maybe my favorite, the Wayne's World anti-commercialism rant for product placement, right? In the middle of Wayne's World when they're told that they need to take on a sponsor, and they're explaining that they're not going to take on sponsors while holding up name brand pizza, wearing Adidas apparel, the Pepsi, the choice of a new generation. They go right through doing a whole bunch of ads, and they got paid for doing that while making a joke about how they're not going to do it and then parodying the whole concept of product placement. They got paid for the product placement. That's clever and funny and really cool. But no, top notch. My favorite plot product placement of all time. The best use. It's in Castaway, but you didn't even think about it at the time, probably. You didn't even realize it was product placement. In fact, for all I know, they may not have actually paid for it. Wilson the volleyball. Wilson, that the product was actually a character in the film. He wasn't just a plot point. He was an actual character who Tom Hanks talks to through 60% of the movie. That's cool. All right? And we all know Wilson. And Wilson the volleyball became a pop culture phenomenon. That's how much we loved Wilson, is that we introduced it into everything, and everyone was making jokes about it, and you'd see parodies of it, and you'd see everyone knew who Wilson was. Well, you got to remember that he called him Wilson because it says Wilson right on the volleyball itself. That's why he named him that. It's the name of the company. And Wilson Sporting Goods reports that, oh yeah, their sales shot up like crazy after that movie. I mean, like up a good 30% right away. And it was so cool that they even went ahead and issued a Castaway Wilson volleyball with the Wilson blood handprint face just printed right there on the volleyball. You just go and buy Wilson exactly like that and play volleyball with him, I would suppose. That's cool. All right. I should start a thread. In fact, I will start a thread. I'll go out to as soon as this episode drops, I'm going to start a thread on product placement and get people to give me some other good examples, because I'm fascinated by this stuff. I love advertising in general. I love product placement. I would love to see more good examples because it interests me. And now it's time for the Badass Movie Quote of the Week. All right. For the first time, I'm going to go revisit a movie that we've already done because I love this quote that much. I love this movie that much. One of the best movies of all time. One of the most quotable movies of all time. I don't even have to tell you what movie. I don't even have to tell you who it is, because you all know it. You ready? Quote, "You only think I guessed wrong. That's what's so funny. I switched glasses when your back was turned. Ha ha, you fool. You fell victim to one of the classic blunders. The most famous is never get involved in a land war in Asia, but only slightly less well known is this. Never go in against a Sicilian when death is on the line. Ha 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 ha." And then, of course, he falls over dead. End quote, I guess. Wally Shawn as Vizzini, the Sicilian from The Princess Bride. Classic scene. Awesome quote. Love it. But enough fooling around. I know what you're all here for. I was going to make this a short episode, and yet, here I am. We don't have any more time to waste. Let's get right into the Pod-O-Matic! Hot dog! This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 in his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble, and he rolls up random topics for me to talk about. Where these topics come from, you ask? Well, that's where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? Well, send your question or topic to me by email, or, better yet, in a private message on our forums, and I will add it to our Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. And, lucky us, R2 has rolled up a 14, which is from Sirius Paul. Sirius Paul says, "In a fight between D&D vampires, Blade, and underworld vampires, who wins?" Okay, here's the problem with the question, is if you pit Blade against vampires, it doesn't matter how powerful they are, Blade always wins. That's the rule of Blade. So there's no getting around that one. However, if you want to compare D&D vampires to underworld vampires, then D&D vampires. I'm sorry, Underworld Vampires, while I love Underworld for being cheesy and stupid and all of the things that it is, it's beautiful. It is vampires versus werewolves with guns. That's what makes it so pretty. You gotta love that concept. But because of that, because they wanted to make it this Matrix-like gun battle between these terrors of the night, they made the vampires a little bit mortal. You know what I mean? They're a little more vulnerable than a vampire really ought to be. And especially in D&D, you're going to have... I mean, your run-of-the-mill vampires are already pretty scary in D&D, but if you're running up against any vampire worth his salt, he's got some character levels piled on there that make him formidable as all hell. You can't stand against that. I mean, unless of course, you're Blade, obviously. Blade would kill any vampire. That's what he does. Number one. That's awesome. This one is from Sirius Paul again. Sirius Paul says, "Have you ever played World of Warcraft?" Dude, no. God, have I ever played any massively multiplayer online game? No. No, I haven't. Not that I don't think I would enjoy it. I do. But, as I've mentioned in the past, I don't have time for video games. I really don't. I have so many really cool video games in this house that my kids have bought and played that I would love to be able to devote, you know, a dozen hours, 30 hours. I would love to spend some time with these games and really get good at them. I don't have the time for it. I certainly don't have time for something that requires a monthly subscription. I wish I could, but I don't. But specifically, World of Warcraft, I'm amazed this came up. We just were talking about this on the website this week, last week, whatever. And have you seen the new commercials? Oh, God, the new commercials, they have taken a race, an entire new race, playable race of Kung Fu Pandas, and put them in the land of Pandaria. Oh, you know what? Bad enough that you have to put Kung Fu Pandas into your game to generate some new interest, but the fact that your creative talent is so limited that the best name you could think of for their land was Pandaria. That's where the pandas live. Pandaria? Seriously? I can't even go on about that one. It just shocks me to my core. No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. You know what? I'm going to have to find some way to edit this one a little bit because that was a terrible answer. I mean, I'm still outraged and shocked. The answer was fine up until that last 2 minutes, and then I don't know where my mind was going. I am distracted because I just ran out of Diet Dr. Pepper. I'm going to have to go get another one. And as soon as I get back, we'll have R2 roll another one for us. And I'm back! All right, let's see. Letterfly, R2, what do you got? Number 85. This one's from Daz. Hey, Daz. Daz says, "Dealing with awkward players in the age brackets of 9 to 12, 12 to 16, and 40 to 45 during D&D. Your thoughts?" Oh, good. I thought there wasn't going to be a question there. Awkward players. Well, I don't know. They're all players. I've already done some. I talk about gaming with my kids all the time. Every age is awkward for different reasons, and so therefore I don't have specific advice, and obviously the 40 to 45 is a nice jab at just a lot of us older nerds. But I don't really have advice for dealing with them other than, you know, treat them all as intelligent players. You know, have fun. Because it's a matter of, I'm playing with little kids who, I mean, you know, my two little ones are 6 and 9, and playing with them is just a matter of getting them involved in the story, getting them started at all, understanding that they're telling a story the way they think a story should be told. They've watched lots of TV and movies and cartoons, and they've got their idea of how these things go, and it doesn't have to be tied to anything that is realistic in any sense. It just has to be a good story, and there has to be some good action, and they have to feel like they've got some control over it. And then when you get up to 9 to 12, I mean, again, it's all about kicking ass. You know, it's getting to the point where at 9 to 12, they can start really grasping the rules, and they can, you know, my brother, I should get some advice from him, because my brother has kids across the spectrum as well, and he does. I think he does a lot more gaming with his kids than I do with mine. So he would have some good advice. He's got 8 of them to deal with. So, like I say, 9 to 12, you know, 12 to 16. I can't really separate them out like that. They're just, as they get older, they're looking for more from their stories. You're not going to expect a bunch of emotional content and investment, you know, in terms of actually role-playing out long soliloquies or big conversations, or, I mean, they're very, very concrete and focused as they're younger. And then as they get older, they're more willing to deal with a more involved storyline. And then as they advance beyond that, yeah, maybe even an involved emotional storyline that doesn't have to dwell around combat and action at every single turn. They're more willing to handle stuff that's more complex, which does not mean that that reflects a more mature style of play necessarily, but there are certain things that younger players can't handle, older ones can. Although, speaking of the awkward ages of 40 to 45, actually from, 30 to 50, as long as you've got kids in the house, this is an awkward time for gaming no matter what you do. Then it's just a matter of, God, can we even get something scheduled? And for me, the answer is almost always no. That's why I breed my own gamers and I game with them. My children are awesome because I can never find time to get together with other adults, even if it's online, where, you know, you'd think it'd be a lot easier to find some time. No. To find some quiet time for 2-3 hours at a stretch, which would be a short game, to find that kind of time to sit down with 3-4 other people and get something going, oh, it's just too challenging. So, anyway, I don't know that I've answered your question, but I have rambled on for a couple minutes, and that should be enough, right? Number 48. This one comes from Dire Cat. Dire Cat says, if you could own any type of computer, what would it be? Oh, darn you, Dire Cat. I want to come up with something very clever and name some famous science fiction computery thing, but the only one I can come up with is HAL, and I certainly don't want to own HAL. But as an honest answer, look, I already told you my laptop's falling apart. So for me, I don't really care. I honestly don't care. I would love for my next one to be one of those rugged workplace laptops, one of those ones where people take them out to their construction sites and stuff, and they've got the rubberized edges and the cushioning in them, and they're it's, you know, full-size laptop, but built a little thicker, a little sturdier. I want some portability, but I don't care that it's huge. I'm going to put it in a bag and carry it on my shoulder anyway. I don't need it to be ultra-lightweight, you know, 2.5 pounds, whatever. I don't need that. I just want it to be portable and sturdy, because this one's getting beat. So that's what I'd be looking for. But to me, the actual kind of computer, I don't do gaming on them, so that's not as important to me. I mean, it's just got to have enough power to do, you know, my day-to-day stuff, make these recordings, do my email, cruise the internet, watch a few videos, whatever. It doesn't have to be really complex for me. And for the most part, as I heard someone else say, look, at this point, you do half your stuff on the internet anyway, so as long as you have a browser available, you know, the shell around it is not all that important. Just make sure it's fast enough, that's all. So, I don't know. I'm a computer dude. I do it for a living. It's all my work. And yet, you know what? One computer is as good as another. I shuffle from machine to machine all the time and use whatever's at hand. Doesn't bother me. Number 67, also from Dire Cat. Dire Cat says, what was your favorite book in high school? That's a tough one. Probably my Calvin and Hobbes books, to be completely honest. Also Farside. I love Calvin and Hobbes. I love Farside. I read those things obsessively. But if you want to talk about real books, real stories, it's a toss-up. I'm still a Lord of the Rings fan, and I read Lord of the Rings a couple times in high school. Loved it. And then I got to the Silmarillion and decided I didn't like that part. But also Dragon Riders. The Dragon Riders of Pern, the whole Pern series. I mean, I read lots and lots of sci-fi fantasy. I read lots of different series. But Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders series, absolutely adored. A friend of my mom's knew that I was an avid reader, knew that I liked sci-fi fantasy, and so she gave me a hardcover edition of the first three Dragon Riders books when I was, I don't know, 13, 14, and said, yeah, I think you'd like these. And sure enough, I did. Oh, it was so good. So that's probably my favorite. You know, as soon as this recording is done, I am going to remember something else that I completely and totally forgot. But I'm going to stick with Dragon Riders for now. Bang! All right, my wife and kids are on their way home. I'm going to have to stop recording soon, so let's make this one our last one. This one comes from my old friend Brasky. Oh, number 36, did I say that? My old friend Brasky asks me, what's your favorite Kids in the Hall sketch? Dude, awesome question. And have I done this one before? It feels like I've done this one before. I can't, they all mix up in my head. I can't remember. Anyway, my favorite Kids in the Hall sketch. Absolutely, Kids in the Hall sketch comedy show from Canada 25 years ago. Brilliant, brilliant stuff. Starring a bunch of people that you would mostly recognize now because they do really cool, funny stuff still to this day. Kind of like The State, but 10 years earlier and Canadian. I guess I would have to explain who The State is. Never mind. Anyway, my favorite Kids in the Hall sketch, by far, the Old Yeller sketch. Okay? There's a lot of them that had good catchphrases. There was the chicken lady, and there was the I'm crushing your head guy, and they had a bunch of cool stuff. But the best one was the Old Yeller sketch. And it's basically a replay of the ending scene of Old Yeller, and Mom's about to go shoot Old Yeller, and then the boy comes up and says, no, Ma, it's my dog. I'll do it. And he takes the shotgun, and he aims off stage, and tearfully he pulls the trigger, and this huge buckets of blood come splashing back to hit everybody in scene. And they never break character, and they always still remain tearful and horrible, and they continue on with a couple more lines. But that was it. That was the, just imagine the final scene of shooting Old Yeller, except it's accompanied with buckets of blood. Like, Carrie style buckets of blood. It was glorious and completely caught me off guard. I must have seen it when I was 15 years old, and I could not stop laughing. So that is the best Kids in the Hall sketch ever. Not just my favorite, but objectively, scientifically verified, the best. You can't argue with scientifically verified, right? Exactly. And that wraps us up, although I have a little surprise, but we'll get to that. But first, you know what comes next.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2012 by Nerd Pride Radio. Our theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. Our bumper music this week, Sam Cooke's Wonderful World, She Blinded Me with Science from William Shatner. And that song by They Might Be Giants is about the books whose name I can't remember right now. I really should look that up for next time. Darn it. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes and write us a nice review, or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. Leave us a message there. If you want to contact me personally, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com, but we all know that that is really kind of a lost cause. To be totally honest, the best way to talk to me is to come sign up for the forums at nerdprideradio.com/forum. Sign up, send me a message, we'll hang out together. We'll have fun. But that's not the end. As it turns out, there's some feedback. You are so going to love this. Do you remember when I got up to go get myself a new Diet Dr. Pepper? Oh, wait, hold on. It's right here. Give me a second. Ah, that is so good. Okay. When I came back, before I started recording again, just for kicks, I went and checked the website just to look around. And guess what? I have a new private message while I'm recording. And because that is, of course, the best way to contact me. My new private message, my feedback, is from Zimnipot. And Zimnipot's title says, Paying the Potomatic Ransom. Excellent. Okay. So I open it up, and it says, okay, it's clear to me now that you are holding the new episode hostage and that you will only release it if I give you enough questions for the Potomatic. Which, by the way, Zimnipot had already sent me a list of 10. All right, but he continues. Well then, looks like I have to pay up. I hope you enjoy them. And then he leaves a smiley face, followed by a list of, I can only assume this is like, I don't know, 50, 70, I don't know how many. It's not quite 100, but he's got a lot of Podomatic entries listed here, which I'm going to add to my list. But because it came in while I was recording, all right, he paid my ransom. It's ready to go. I am going to have R2 roll us up a number, and we are going to pick right off of this list. All right, he didn't number them, but like I say, there's at least 50. So you know what? R2, you roll me a number, we'll divide by 2, and that's the one that we're going to take. Are you ready? And the number is 35, so let's divide by 2. Do I round up or round down? Round up or no, we have to round up, because otherwise 1 has to round up to 1. We can't have a 0. So 35, so we're 18. Let's count down the list. 1, 2, All right. Okay, here we go. Number 18 on Zimnipot's brand new list of a zillion new Podomatic entries says, who is the fourth person on your missed calls list? Oh, that's a good question. Let me go look. Hold on. Oop, phone. And where is it? There. And options. Missed calls. There it is. Well, it's my wife, Nadia, of course. Right before that, I missed 2 calls from my brother-in-law and then another call from my wife. That's really, you know, seriously, I'm surprised that my brother-in-law's even in there. If I've got missed calls, it's Nadia, Gygax, Nadia. I mean, that's really pretty much the whole list if I'm going to miss calls. And it's always for the exact same reason, okay? We went to the stupid school thing the other night, and so while I'm there, I put my phone on silent. I completely forget that my phone is on silent. Well, it's on vibrate. And it always takes her about 4 or 5 calls for me to notice that my phone is on silent. And so that's the only reason I ever have missed calls. Well, not the only reason, but that's the largest reason why I have missed calls is because I put my phone on silent and I have completely forgotten. But yeah, it's my wife. So good call, Zimny. I'm so glad you wrote in, man. I can't tell you how tickled I am to get some feedback while I record and bring it out to you almost as if it's live, except, you know, you guys won't hear this for like another 3 or 4 days, but that's okay by me.